Welcome to the iPod, a podcast series from Ophthalmology Times, where we engage with key opinion leaders about the latest innovations in the areas of surgery, clinical diagnosis, drug therapy, research, technology, or practice management.
So we're joined today by Dr. John H. Mary, who has been in solo private practice in West Palm Beach, Florida for the past 49 years, and still enjoys his practice in three languages, English, Spanish, and Haitian Creole. And Dr. Mary is also in the unique position that he may be the only Holocaust survivor still in practice in ophthalmology. Welcome, Dr. Mary.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we wanted, begin at the beginning, right? So you were born on June 14th, 1940 in Budapest, Hungary, which is in the background behind you with your picture there.
Yes.
Obviously before the Holocaust. So what do you remember about your family and your daily life then?
Well, I don't have too many memories of Hungary. My only memory is in 1944. My mother is sitting on a suitcase and she's crying. And I ask her, "Why are you crying?" And she answers, "We have to leave all this here." And that's my only memory, a vague memory of going down to the basement during air raids, Allied air raids.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, for someone so young, I mean, that must have been so just confusing and concerning. I mean, what went through your mind?
Well, it wasn't so confusing and concerning because during the entire period, I was with my parents. And that always gave me a lot of security. And so I never had to think about strange people or strange situations.
Okay. And did you have any siblings or?
No, I'm the only child.
Could you talk a little bit about your parents and your grandparents during that time?
All right. We were an upper middle class family in Budapest. My father was a graduate civil engineer from the Technical University in Budapest, but he also ran a marble business. My mother did not, she was a high school graduate. She received her baccalaureate from high school, but she did not have any profession. Mm-hmm. My grandparents, my father's father was a teacher, an elementary school teacher in Budapest. My grandfather was the distributor for the Manor Confectionery Company for all of Hungary. Mm-hmm. This company, the Manor Confectionery Company, exists today. In fact, if you go to Vienna today and you go to St. Stephen's Cathedral, right next to it is the Manor store.
Oh,
and you can get cookies and candies and towels and bags, anything you want with the Manor logo on it. And the logo is St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna.
Have you been back? Have you seen that?
Yeah, we were there with two grandchildren last summer.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So, I mean, it sounds, you know, like a pretty nice life, right?
My mother's father was well-to-do. He owned apartment buildings, and there were no financial issues.
Mm-hmm. And then it changed, right? Everything drastically changed.
Everything changed March 19th, 1944. Hungary had been allied with Germany, but not occupied. But this changed in March 19th when German soldiers entered and occupied Hungary, and Hungary became an occupied country. The day after the Germans entered, Adolf Eichmann entered also. By this time, he was a very experienced person, having masterminded the deportations in the rest of Europe. He immediately divided Hungary into six zones, five the provinces and one Budapest. Budapest would be the last zone. The Holocaust in Hungary consisted of three steps: the Yellow Star, ghettoization, and deportation. The entire process was carried out by the Hungarian gendarmerie, not by the Germans. They did not have the manpower to carry this out, but the Hungarian gendarmerie was a very willing accomplice.
Talk a little bit about, you know, what were some of the events that played out, like, for you personally in your family since that day?
Well, the deportations in Hungary in the provinces began May 15th, 1944, and ended June 9th, 1944. During this time, 437,000 Jewish people were deported to Auschwitz. What took place in Poland during 3 years took place in Hungary in 54 days. After the deportations in the provinces, there remained only one Jewish community left in Hungary, and those were the Jews of Budapest. So we were in a dilemma what to do. Mm-hmm. And my uncle, Dr. Nisan Kahan, was a Zionist, and he was aware of this transport that was being organized by Dr. Kastner. And he presented to the family the choice: if you stay in Budapest, you will perish 100%. If you go on this transport, you will perish 99%. On the basis of this 1% difference, the family decided to go on what would later be called the Kastner transport or the Kastner train.
Mm-hmm. And again, as a young boy, I mean, did you understand?
No, I knew nothing. I don't remember the trip to Bergen-Belsen. I know it took 9 days. We arrived in a small town in northern Germany called Bergen-Belsen, a name that meant at that time nothing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same connotation as it has today when it sends shivers up people's spines. At that time, it was a camp. We didn't know the full implications of it.
Mm-hmm. And on that train, that journey to there, do you remember anything, like,
no, I don't remember anything.
Any of it.
I was told various things. There were a few surprises. Number one, we went by cattle car. Number two, a day or two into the trip, rumor swept the train that we were going to Auschwitz. However, it turns out that we were passing through a Czechoslovakian town called Auschwitz. Mm. That was the source of the confusion. One letter does make a difference.
Yeah, one letter. Wow.
And the third surprise, which my mother related to me, was that we passed through the Austrian city of Linz. At that time, all the passengers were told to undress and to go into a shower. And my mother related to me that she didn't know whether water or gas would be coming out.
Yeah.
So those were the three surprises right away.
When you were at the actual camp itself, like, what was daily life like? Did your family work, or?
We were a little bit different from the other parts of the camp in two respects. One, we didn't have to work. And number two, we didn't have to wear uniforms. Society reconstituted itself in the camp. The doctors ran a clinic. The teachers ran classes. The rabbis ministered to their congregations. So in a way, a mini society reformed. One of the main activities in the camp was appel, or roll call, and this was done twice a day, rain or shine. I was sick a lot, but I do remember something that nobody could have told me because nobody knew. I remember a certain gesture that the SS had in counting, and the gesture was like this, counting, 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 to make sure that nobody had escaped.
Hmm. And what would happen if there was not the head count? They found somebody missing.
Well, it never happened. Everybody was accounted for. There was no possibility of escape anyway. So, but anyway, this was the, as everywhere where the SS had camps, the appel or the roll call was a very important part of the day. Then after we were there for 6 weeks, there were 40 members of my family in the camp and on this transport. After 6 weeks, 11 members of my family were allowed to go to Switzerland. At this point, my mother went up to the commandant in Bergen-Belsen and said, could we just not join them? At which point he said, sind Sie wahnsinnig? Are you crazy? To challenge the German authority. And so we were left behind. The rest of our family left after 6 weeks. We were there September, October, November, December.
Yeah. So, I mean, that must have caused a lot of angst and uncertainty, you know, obviously being separated.
Yes, we didn't know what was going to happen to us. And then one day, we were told the next day we're leaving. The entire group walked from the camp to the train station at Bergen-Belsen, except old people and sick people and kids were taken by truck. My parents entrusted me to an elderly lady, and we got to the station. It was dark, it was rainy, it was cold. I couldn't find my parents. 1,500 people are milling about. Finally, we did find each other, and the train trip began. Mm-hmm. We came to Bergen-Belsen in a cattle car. We left in a passenger car.
And what day did you arrive across the...
We arrived in Switzerland, December... on or about December 7th, it was Hanukkah 1944. Mm-hmm. One of the other dangers was that Germany was being heavily, heavily bombed. The train could easily have been bombed. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine told me that she saw bombings through the window, but no bomb hit our train.
Thankfully.
And when we arrived at the border, Dr. Kastner was still negotiating for us, and it wasn't sure until the last minute that we would be allowed to go into Switzerland. Hmm. Had we stayed in Bergen-Belsen another 2-3 months, we would have perished. There were no gas chambers. It was just from the elements. Mm-hmm. The lack of food, the cold, the disease.
Mm-hmm. The actual conditions itself. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so you're very fortunate.
Yes. Very, very fortunate.
Yeah. And it's coincidentally or ironically, the day you arrived was 3 years to the day when, you know, the U.S. was drawn into World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I mean, do you find that kind of appropriate or ironic or...
Well, I think part of the success of Dr. Kastner's negotiations was the declining military fortunes of the Germans. This would not have taken place in 1942. But in 1944, the military fortunes had declined and people were already perhaps looking at what was coming afterwards.
So, I mean, after that incredible day, I mean, kind of take us a little bit forward then. How did your family start your lives again after?
Well, then we were we arrived in Switzerland. We were put in what's called in German Heim, or in English a home, unoccupied hotels most of the time. We were in a Heim in Territe, right outside Montreux, walking distance from the castle of Chillon, which is very famous in pictures. I went to a kindergarten there. I don't remember much about it, but I probably they spoke French there. And lo and behold, I took 4 years of French in high school and 4 years in college, and I was a pre-med French major. And the French exchange student said that my accent was better than the professor's. And the only reason I could ascribe to that was that in early childhood, I had exposure to French.
What kind of drew you into ophthalmology after studying pre-med?
Well, I was in medical school, and time came to pick a specialty. There was a book of medical specialties, and I read the whole book. And I liked ophthalmology. It was medical. It was surgical. You dealt with people their entire lives, from childhood to older age. I liked it that it was a little bit limited. And so I chose ophthalmology.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you study for ophthalmology?
I went to medical school at Columbia, and then my ophthalmology was NYU Bellevue Medical Center, which today includes NYU Langone Medical Center. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful program. The chairman was Dr. Goodwin Brynan.
You know, today, I mean, you've been obviously practicing, as you say, for 49 years. I mean, that's incredible. What do you attribute to your success?
Well, I've always put patients first. I tell the patients sometimes, take a good look at this office. You're never going to see it again. And what I mean by that is this 20th century ophthalmology office with one doctor and two staff, and everybody knows each other, and family atmosphere. This is not the wave of the future. The wave of the future is big practices with many, many doctors, all the subspecialties, IT department, and so on. I've always liked languages, and that's come in very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. And today I speak one-third English, one-third Spanish, and one-third Haitian Creole.
That's great.
And I have the entire spectrum of ages, and I have the entire spectrum of society.
You may be the only Holocaust survivor who still is in the practice of ophthalmology.
I may be. We don't know for sure who's out there.
Are you aware of others that they've come across?
I'm not aware of others in practice today. Mm-hmm. I know one other person who's in OBGYN, and he's still in practice in New York, but I don't know anybody in ophthalmology.
Mm-hmm. Well, so as a Holocaust survivor, you know, how in today's, you know, all that's going on in our world today, how might your experience shape, you know, the your views about the social movements and demonstrations taking place today?
Well, I'm a progressive. I've had the experience of prejudice and hate, and I'm sensitive to what's going on. I'm sensitive to minorities, racial minorities, women, LGBT, and again, I have the entire spectrum of society in my practice. I've always worked with Medicaid and the lower income people. I think my experience has made me a little more sensitive.
And then, as you know, as an ophthalmologist, given the novel coronavirus in itself has been one major health crisis to contend with, and then amid the pandemic, the protests over social injustices continue nationwide, with many physician groups decrying systemic racism as a public health issue. So how does one manage the challenge of two health crises simultaneously?
Well, you do the best you can. My wife, who's also a physician, both of us did not stop practicing at any point. including March and April, when the American Academy of Ophthalmology recommended that we stop, but we just never did. Mm-hmm. We continued right on. We take all the precautions, and that's it. We just keep going.
Mm-hmm. How have your experiences, the blending, I guess, of your experiences as, you know, having survived the Holocaust and being an ophthalmologist served you in this pandemic? I mean, is this something that you would have ever imagined, having endured that and now?
Well, I was a little bit familiar with it because I had heard all my life about the pandemic of 1918-1919. During this time, in December of 1918, my grandmother passed away in Hungary, and she passed away from the Spanish influenza. So I knew that this existed. I didn't know any details about it. Later, I found out that there were three waves of the pandemic in 1918-19, and the second wave was worse than the first and or the third. So far, this pandemic is playing out the timetable of the 1918-19 pandemic.
So history repeats itself, or it's just
we learn from history. 101 years later, history repeats itself. My parents and my relatives never spoke about the pandemic. Everybody had survived except my grandmother. I know she was in an oxygen tent, because people ask me, how do you know that that she died of Spanish influenza? I said, because I was told that, and I know that it was in December of 1918, and that she was in an oxygen tent. And she was definitely a victim. She was 44 years old.
So why is it important for you now to share your, you know, your story of the Holocaust as a survivor?
Well, we have some issues going on right now. One is Holocaust denial, and this has become more prevalent. And in fact, many Holocaust survivors are trying to get in touch with Zuckerberg to put down these Holocaust denial posts. We all agree with free speech, but as a famous justice said, free speech does not give you the license to cry fire in a crowded theater. There are limits. And it's very painful to us and to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust to say that it didn't occur. How could it not occur? I was there. Where was I between July 1st, 1944 and December 7th?
So I guess, you know, with the Holocaust Museum and everything, does your family have any artifacts in the
We knew somebody at the museum, and she was coming down to West Palm Beach, mm-hmm. and she was going to come to see what material we had. So I laid everything out on a table, and I said to Judith, look, this is everything I have, my childhood baby albums and documents and parents' identity cards and diplomas and so on. I said, look, take what you think are useful and leave the others behind. She took everything, every last thing. They are this minute quite busy with contributions, but that is going to end very soon. So they are taking everything, and my baby albums, the two volumes, can be accessed from any computer, and it's already online through the Holocaust Museum website. And so are documents, and so is my wife's family also.
So what was maybe your most prized or favorite artifact?
Well, my most prized artifact was my father was an amateur photographer, and he took pictures daily, and it for everybody it's just amazing how normal everyday life was in Budapest at the same time that the Jewish communities in the rest of Europe had been destroyed. We were still having Hanukkah parties, And we're going to a summer house in the mountains of Buda, and we're going here and there. Amazing day-to-day, everyday life. And then it just stopped. And that was the end.
Such a contrast.
Yes.
So is there any other a favorite story you like to tell or anything as you think back through this experience? Or?
Well, I've had Holocaust survivors as patients. And I, in fact, even to this day. And I remember one Holocaust survivor, she had the numbers written on her arm, and I showed it to staff members. And one day she came in with her daughter, and just to make small talk, I told the daughter, I understand that the Holocaust affects the next generation also. She almost screamed at me, you better believe it. Why do you think I've been going to a psychologist for all these years? I retreated. But yes, it does affect subsequent generations and even two generations and three generations down the road. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think so, but it does. There was an article in the newspaper this week of a Holocaust survivor locally here in West Palm Beach, in Boynton Beach, who was a survivor, and he died of COVID. And his entire story was written up in the newspaper, and he described that they were getting ready to board the train for the deportation, and somebody shouted out, Fisher family. And so they went to this, a soldier or a gendarme, shouted out, Fisher family. They went to this man. He escorted them out. He got them into a safe place, and they survived the Holocaust. They don't even know who it was. Who it was, why he did it. He said his father had a bakery. They knew a lot of people. Maybe that person recognized them. And in one moment of good deed, he saved a family. This is a story that I had never heard, but it was written in this personal story of this man who passed away of COVID recently. So these personal stories are important.
Absolutely.
It's part of history.
Mm-hmm. You know, bringing it up to today, you know, what is your vision for the future, both in ophthalmology and in the future in general?
I always said I'm not going to retire until I reach 2020. So came 2020, and so I found another excuse not to retire. I'm not going to retire until I'm in practice 50 years. 49 years won't do. The future of ophthalmology, as we talked about before, are large, large practices. The small practices are being bought up by private equity companies, and small individual practices just cannot make it anymore. And the future are large practices, everything computerized, IT departments, and so on. And that's the future, and the people will have to get used to it. Some of the patients who are used to the old system may have a little problem, but in the end, everybody will get used to it.
And as far as the future, just the future of...
Ophthalmology is a fabulous field. I mean, it's changed totally from front to back. The cornea, you can do so many things. You can do refractive surgery. Cataract surgery is a totally different process today than it was 50 years ago. The retina, which when I was in my training, you couldn't do practically nothing in the retina. Today, it's a field of vast therapeutics. So everything has changed and changed for the better. Ophthalmology is a fantastic field. You can do something for your patients.
All right. Well, Dr. Mary, we thank you so much for your time and continued wishes for you, continued success, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the iPod. We hope you subscribe at iTunes and let us know what topics you'd like to hear more about. Stay connected by going to ophthalmologytimes.com, subscribing to our newsletter, and following us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We'll see you next time.